A diagnosis of breast cancer can cause a life-changing ripple effect of impact, affecting those we love the most and those upon whom we lean for comfort and strength in the most challenging of times. My name is Aisling Hurley and I'm the CEO of Breast Cancer Ireland, and you're listening to More Than a Lump, a podcast that talks openly and honestly to a selection of guests about their very personal connections to breast cancer, be it through their career choice, their own first-hand experience of the disease, or through sharing the experience of close family members. My conversations will center on how breast cancer has informed their perspective on life, love, family, health, their goals, and indeed aspirations. Although each story is utterly unique, the one common thread that runs through each one is that breast cancer is more than a lump. This episode of More Than a Lump is proudly supported by CarePlus Pharmacy. CarePlus is Ireland's leading community pharmacy brand, offering expert advice and services for a healthier and happier you. You can find your nearest CarePlus on careplus.ie or follow them on social media for daily health and wellness tips. Emma Meir was diagnosed with stage 3 HER2 negative breast cancer in October 21 after noticing a lump on her breast just a month earlier. Now a year on, the mum of two girls feels things are now beginning to get back to normal. Emma joins me today along with Laura Austin, also a mum of two girls who was diagnosed with stage 3 triple negative breast cancer in 2018. Both women chat to me today about the role their careers and work had in their treatment journey and how they coped with the various challenges of work. I've invited HR specialist Ian Meegan to join us today too, to give us a perspective on this topic and to tease out some of the issues. I appreciate this is a massive topic, and I know it can be so personal to your treatment plan, your family, your support network, and can depend on your employers, and indeed there are financial imperatives to take into account. But I suppose, like many of our More Than a Lump episodes, we hope in this episode to unpack just some of the issues and share a perspective and the experiences of others who have travelled this path with our listeners. Emma and Laura, so lovely to meet you again today, and Ian, lovely to meet you, and welcome you to More Than a Lump community. Before I dive into the topic of today's podcast, namely returning to work, I wonder, could I turn first of all to you, Emma, as your diagnosis is the most recent. You were diagnosed last October and are coming to the end of your treatment.
Yes.
Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. Hi. I went just to the GP last September, and then obviously wasn't happy with the lump, and thankfully she put me straight through for the triple assessment test for the mammogram, the ultrasound and the biopsy. And lo and behold, within about 4 or 5 days, we heard back and was told, yeah, to come in. So I did. And I asked should I bring someone? And they said, yep. So my husband came with me. And yes, we were told there and then by the consultant, we don't know how bad, but it is breast cancer and we need to do further investigation. So like anyone, you get more tests, you get scans, you get more biopsies, you get nodes checked, you know, that's standard procedure. So they're covering every avenue, but it's quite grueling because you don't know, it's all new. And that was, you know, hard, but I had a good support network, my husband, my family, my girls and friends rallied around. And then within a month, I suppose they knew then, yes, it's bigger than a lump. It's, you know, so this tumor needs to be removed, but it's also the breast. So I did get a mastectomy in December, and luckily I got an implant there and then, which was helpful. So one consultant out and one puts in. So all very good. And within a few days, I was home with a few drips and the usual and recovery. And then following that was post-treatment was chemotherapy. Okay. Started in February then till June. I had 8 sessions of that every 2 weeks. And then I had a rest for about 3 weeks. And then in July and August, 20 days of radiotherapy. All really to blast it all out.
Yeah.
That it doesn't come back. That is the risk. And here I am a year on. It was only the 1st of October since my diagnosis, as you said. It's just great to be here because unfortunately both my parents died of stomach cancer. So it kind of, you know, it was on my mind always. One, my mum died at 54.
Wow.
I'm 52. Uh-huh. And she only lasted 8 months, but it's very different. That was back in 97.
Okay.
And now the medicine and the good work that BCI is doing is just fantastic. Mm-hmm. We're all, you know, staying alive. We're beating cancer. It doesn't take every life. Yes, there are some, but I do feel now with medicine and the doctors and the professions, and research what they're doing is great, mm-hmm. and that hopefully I'll live a lot longer.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I suppose across to you, Laura, you're the mum of Sive and Aveen, who I met when you kindly brought them along to our Great Pink Run back in July 2020. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about your story?
Okay, well, I suppose I was diagnosed in June 2018. Mm. I found a lump in the shower like many other women. When I do my breast check, I found it and went to the GP straight away, and she sent me to the rapid access breast clinic in the Mater, and went on the 31st of May. And that day I knew I had breast cancer. Had obviously the mammogram and went in to have what they thought was a cyst drained in the radiology suite. And when I saw the radiologist's face, I knew that it was definitely something more sinister. And then went on in June to have a lumpectomy and node clearance. And then 2 weeks later, then again, they hadn't quite got all the margins around the tumour. So had to go back and have more surgery done. And that was in July. And then I started my chemotherapy. I had 16 sessions of chemotherapy. Started at the end of August, just before the week before Sive actually started school. And then I finished that in January of 2019. I had a month kind of free then, and then started my 20 sessions of radiotherapy. So mm-hmm. finished my treatment at the end of February 2019. So
yeah, wow.
It's a long time ago.
Yeah. But I mean, listen, and you're here talking about it. And I suppose if I loop back to you, Emma, just to say, you manage your own business. You have Playball Kids. Mm-hmm. How did that interfere or not interfere with your treatment?
I worked around work with my treatment, with my family, and I was lucky. Running your own business, I suppose you can take a back seat and stop working, finish in schools or creches or wherever I was, but you don't want to lose the business. So being self-employed, I have staff but as well. But, you know, you like to be there yourself at most of the venues. So I just reduced where I was. Like, for instance, the summer just gone, I had only just finished chemo, and then at radio, I did 3 weeks of camps, not 8 weeks, you know, of summer camps, things like that. Yeah. So I made some good decisions, and I also had someone that could run them and I could come and go. But I was working nearly every day. Mm. There's always admin or something. And then I also do strength and conditioning, MBE coaching is my company as well. So I'm busy doing that. And hockey coaching. So I do an awful lot. I work actually still 7 days a week at the moment, actually physically. So I need to change that. But I am a worker. Mm. But if I wasn't working, I'm at home and I get upset.
Okay.
Like I feel, you know, I need to be busy, do anything but housework. So I do tend to go out, and I have a good husband, but that suits me. But some days it's just 2 hours of hockey coaching. So it's not always. And I love my sports and out coaching. Yeah. So senior school.
I suppose you have to listen to the body as well at times. So that does bring you back a little bit, and you do have to sort of say, well, if I have to rest, I have to rest.
Yeah. I think I was exceptionally lucky though.
Okay.
I think on talking with some of the support groups and warrior groups I'm with, you know, they call them. Luckily, you know, I was 3 days in hospital after, say, the mastectomy and implant. Then I was probably 2 days after house chemo and after radio. So everything, and just tablets worked, but a lot of people, the doctors will work to get the right medication. Yes, you know, things don't always work.
Yeah.
You have instances or things don't repair easily. I was very lucky. I was lucky I was able to keep going and be very strong for the girls at home. You know, my Sophie and Katie, my twins, were doing their leaving. So they had I was still doing chemo through June, and you know, they were remarkable. Thankfully, they're both doing really well. They're both in Commerce and UCD, and you know, that is terrific. I don't need to worry about them as much anymore. But it was a tough year.
Yeah.
But it's only made them more resilient.
Uh-huh.
Seeing mum, and I talk about it with them, and you know, I just included them and was honest at that age. It must be a lot harder when they're young.
And so to you, Laura, you went back as a senior transplant coordinator in Beaumont Hospital. How soon after your treatment did you return, and how was that for you?
I went back a month after I finished radiotherapy. I kind of said, God, it was a bit of a mad thing to go back. But for me, it was really, really important to go back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a bit like yourself, it was, I didn't want to be at home, because when I was at home, I was just, you know, the mam that had a bald head, or, you know, the mam that had just finished treatment. So I needed to take back a bit of myself. and come back to work. And I suppose I needed the support of my colleagues as well. You know, I just come through the worst time of my life, you know, and my girls were in school and my husband was continuing to work and I was just at home. So it was really important for me to get back into work. I knew I couldn't go back full time. And I suppose I was really, really lucky with my own nursing manager and with the colleagues that I work with that they afforded me the opportunity to go back. I initially went back just 16 hours a week and I didn't go back into my senior role. One of my colleagues had taken my role for the time I was out and she agreed to continue on until I was back full time. So I was really, really lucky. But, you know, from my mental health point of view, I needed to get back. You know, I needed to feel that I was doing something other than cleaning the house or, you know, collecting the kids from school. I needed something that was me.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And also, I suppose, bringing you back into that sense of purpose again, you know, that, you know, because you can dwell too much on what you've just been through and we've heard. And it's not even dwelling too much. It's more about you go down a rabbit hole of, oh my God, why did that happen to me? And that in itself can set people back, you know, and it has set people back. I suppose turning to you, Ian, you've worked in HR for many years through your own business, liaising with employers and employees, and now in-house in the corporate world. A huge opening question, I know, but in your experience, what's the biggest issue you've seen coming up for those returning to work after a serious illness such as cancer?
Yeah, firstly, thank you, Laura and Emma, for sharing your stories there. I think certainly from my experience, I think it's the lack of understanding and it's the fear factor of not knowing what to do. So I think, particularly in Ireland, we live in such a, and you don't see it until you're in my kind of viewpoint of employment law and the fear of getting sued for this and sued for that and claimed for that, that employers are fearful of something different, are fearful of somebody being sick. But you take it to the next level. It's something that Laura and Emma have shared. And you know, smaller organizations or mid-sized organizations, they're not entirely sure what to do. Mm. And they don't know where to go to. So they don't know how to react. So they don't know how to support. Mm. And it can create, you know, uncertainty for the employee. Because you're the sufferer, but you don't know really, where do I stand as an employee in the organization? And then you have the employer who's feeling very vulnerable, not sure what to do.
Yeah.
And if there isn't a midway point there or somebody to get the individuals in a room to have a conversation, it can be extremely stressful for the sufferer of whatever it is and for the employer as well. Mm. So I think it is challenging. I think, you know, the cliche of COVID, but it has changed. It's starting to change how employers deal with employees in terms of the psychological, and I still see the psychological impact of Dublin, Ireland being locked down.
Yeah.
You take it to people with severe illnesses, whether it's mental or physical. We're getting better, but we're a long, long way away, in my opinion, from when I was, and disappointingly so.
Yeah.
You know, from you know, I've been doing this 20 odd years and it's a gradual change. It's not a quick change, but it does depend on industries. It depends on the type of business, et cetera, et cetera. You need those structures in the workplace that allow the conversation to happen for either cancer related illnesses or for mental related illnesses, because you'll read plenty of stuff online and I laugh at your don't look up Google, but there are all these advisories on there should be somebody set up to help with bullying issues in the workplace and disciplinary issues in the workplace. But there's nothing concrete saying who's there to represent the employees from a mental health. It should be HR, but the smaller the organization, there may not be a HR function. Mm-hmm. They may not be individuals that are able for it. Mm. So then you need training. You need, you know, employers to step out from kind of hiding behind the legislation or the standard things that everybody goes to and understand the illness, understand how it impacts the individual and have that conversation, learn from Emma or Laura and understand what they're going through.
So communication is key.
Huge. And then you make the plan.
Yeah.
And then you understand what potentially, you know, Laura and Emma are going to go through. Mm-hmm. And you can work through a work plan that works for the employer and works for the employee.
the fear for lots of people listening who have been diagnosed is, I want to go back to work. I want to get back into my role that I had that somebody else has now stepped into, a bit like maternity. But how do I make sure that my employer understands I'm fit and healthy as I am, even though in the back of my head I'm still worried about my illness? That makes sense.
It does, because there's still the stigma, you know, and I see it myself in personal circumstances with friends who've had different illnesses and issues. Yeah. And that starting point was a real struggle for them because they were uncomfortable to go and share something that intimate about something that's going on in their life. The person sitting opposite on the employer side was really uncomfortable because they don't know how to react. But again, it comes down to that point I made earlier about the research, about understanding, about ensuring that you've you know, got the detail from the employee around what's happening with them. And again, doing your own research about what they might expect. As you said, looking on the correct websites, not just Googling. Yeah. Get involved. Make it less strange.
Yeah.
You know, share it within reason with the team and let an intimate number of the team understand that, you know, Emma or Laura are going through something personal at the moment. Mm-hmm. And don't let it become, God, you know, Laura wasn't in again for another week and go, I wonder where Emma is and what's going on.
Yeah.
It open it up a little bit more in the right environment and in a respectful way. Mm-hmm. And it becomes less strange, so that when people come back to the workplace after a long gap or there's been a long period of treatment, there isn't the strangeness. Mm-hmm. There's going to be the change, the hair loss, maybe facial personality a little bit because you're going through lots of different things. But make the workplace that safe environment so it doesn't feel strange.
And I suppose, going back to it, it is having that open and honest conversation with, you know, other staff, or your colleagues that you work with, and indeed your employer, in saying, well, look, realistically, this is where I'm at. This is potentially where I can be in 6 months or a year's time, you know, so that they get a sense of understanding, you know, because it's hard. If I flip and say the employer, it's hard on the employer too, because if they're not really sure, are you back or are you only partially back, or are you coming back for a month and then you're going to be gone for 3 months? So they are trying to plan. Everybody's trying to plan. You know, you as an employee, you're trying to get back in as best you can in your own physical and mental side of things. And they're trying to equally plan for the same thing. So it is about really having that two-way conversation
as openly
and honestly as you can.
It is. I mean, Trinity did a great questionnaire survey with a small group of individuals suffering from breast cancer returning to the workplace back in May of this year. And a large proportion, the biggest issue that came out of it was that lack of information, not knowing, you know, for your situation, Emma, in terms of being self-employed, Ireland's a disgrace because Ireland has no support structures for people who are self-employed. You won't get any health benefits. You won't get anything to cover the loss of salary while you're sick. So people need to know that if you're self-employed or you're in that environment, you know, it has a detrimental impact and you've still got to run your business.
Oh, yeah.
And for you, Laura, you know, you had maybe a better environment. And I do think civil service, to an extent, has a better grip of dealing with these kind of issues than the private sector.
Yeah.
It comes down to the organizations that are really proactive, and that's the key. You know, and again, schools, things where they're used to dealing with things, the bigger the org, sometimes the less likely they are at being able to kind of cope. And again, that's why those conversations are important. Mm-hmm. There's other avenues out there in terms of the law and employees being protected under legislation, unfair dismissals, you know, equality, diversity, all of these things, but they're headings.
I know.
They're meaningless.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the day, if you're going down that route with a solicitor or the legal, you've lost control and also lost your, particularly if you're suffering from something, the emotional stress that's going to take having to deal with that nonsense as well. And employers should not be putting anyone in that situation, but they do.
Yeah, can I ask you, is it normal for businesses, whatever size, to have a salary protection scheme in place? Or is it only certain types of businesses have it?
It's only certain types of businesses that have it. Yeah.
Okay. And I ask that because I do know in relation to the likes of teachers and the INTO and things like that, because we deal a lot with Corn Market Financial and they are people who look after the salary protection. And I remember one lady, a teacher, who said, you know, only for that salary protection, while she was diagnosed, helped to support her income going through her diagnosis. She said she would have been in serious bad state.
Yeah, and again, you know, it's the good point of this podcast tonight is about, and again, continuing on the more serious side, is understanding what are
entitlements.
What is it within the employee handbook or what's within my contract? You know, what can HR do or what can the company do to help me? Because again, I would argue strongly that in this situation, particularly going through a cancer diagnosis, everything should be done to try and help the employee get through the difficult situation. If that's fiscally, particularly now that we hear the cost of living, all of those things, that has detrimental impact on your health. I haven't experienced it, thankfully, but you know, both of you have been through it and having the strain of financial burdens on top of other things just isn't good mentally or physically.
And do you think that businesses should or could facilitate phased return to work? I suppose it depends on the business.
Again, it depends on the business, but I think they should. Look, we've gone through COVID, so all bets are off now. You know, all the drama, all the white noise, oh, how the country will fall apart and the world will fall. It didn't.
Yeah.
People got on with work and they've continued to get on with work. Mm-hmm. There's still a huge amount of people who work from home. So phased return, absolutely. I mean, I would do it for my own colleagues, from breaking an arm to something happening with a sick child, whatever it is. So for a situation like this, absolutely achievable. And again, you know, if it's somebody that has been out of the office for a long period of time, I would absolutely recommend the phased approach. Get a feel, you know, Laura, you were talking about the 16 hours. It's just getting a feel for what's working well. You know, if you were involved in a specific area of work, if it meant more travel, more human contact, whether it was face-to-face or traveling, just gently going back to it lets you see where you're at and then have a review and put milestones. You know, Ian, let's do 2 weeks of me doing 16 hours each week and let me see where I am for week three. And absolutely, and even if it's a smaller organization, again, once that conversation's had from the start and the plan is made, you'll know yourself as the individual suffering what you're milestones are in terms of what you can do and what you can physically deal with.
And Laura, you mentioned like you went back on your phased basis.
Yeah.
16 hours a week, but not to your role, not to your senior role at that time. And how did that feel?
To be honest, I was just really delighted to be back. I knew myself I wasn't able for the managerial role that I would normally have. So I was really just happy to be back in the office, you know. What I found difficult was actually the amount of people, because our office is extremely busy, you know. And I found it very, very difficult with the noise and the amount of people that were actually around. So doing 16 hours a week was fantastic for me. And I did that for a number of weeks and then kind of went up to 20. And then I did it in conjunction with occupational health. So they kind of afforded me the opportunity to work as much as I needed to, you know, then kind of went up to 24 hours and didn't go back to full time until October. But I suppose as I got to do more hours, I started to get niggly. I kind of, you know, I wanted to get back into my role. I was obviously feeling a lot better, you know, and I had worked with an amazing bunch of women, you know, and my colleague Andrea, who took over my role, you know, she kind of let me gently get back into it, you know. So,
and did she step aside or how did she, what did she take on as a role?
Well, she went back into her normal role, you know, but she obviously did most of the managerial stuff right up until October. And then that was the plan. We had the plan that by October I would be back up to full time and then I'd go back into my role, you know.
So it comes back to that whole communication side of things, Ian.
It does. And I think, you know, in that situation where you're one of the lucky ones, unfortunately, and it's a great example of, you know, being moved out of the role, not for any reason other than you're in the healing phase and trying to get back into the role. But again, that's a very important conversation for others that are listening to make sure there's something in writing there, that there's documented evidence that if you're being moved out of a role, it is for a period of time. And when you're up and running, that you can absolutely move back into that position. But also the other person that's covering for you, I would advise that you've had a conversation there, that their understanding is that they're going to be
It's not infinite. It is, you know, there's a finite time here.
And we did. We very open communication about it, you know, so we had kind of a defined plan. But but I did that with a very good manager, with occupational health behind me as well, and with an amazing team of people behind me. And, you know, like you have to look after the service as well. And the service, that was the most important thing for me, to be honest, was that the service still ran the same and I couldn't do the service or my team justice at that time.
Yeah.
And my colleague could, you know, so until I knew I was right back where I should be, you know, I didn't go back full time.
And I suppose then looking at Emma's situation as a self-employed, little or no real support, but what is there?
There really is nothing. There really, really is nothing. I mean, it's, and having ran my own and my wife more recently, who had a difficult situation with a 50-year-old business and then fell, broke her hip, and, you know, in her current role, nothing, no support, no nothing. And you know, Emma would relate to this in terms of the amount of PRSI, universal social charge that you're you're paying. For what? It's one of the black holes here in Ireland that needs to be looked at, because it's again, you need it to work. Why should you be any different from anyone else? But you've got nothing there that protects you. So you're so vulnerable as a self-employed person, either on any level of illness, but particularly, you know, cancer, with the amount of time that you need to spend at treatments. So it's quite, and I did, you know, spend a little bit of time having a little bit of research to see and talking to friends who've been through cancer as a self-employed, and more shocked than I was at how little. For those that are employed, working for organisations, I mean, there are things there in terms of whatever the organisation is offering. So again, repeating it, it's get familiar with the employee handbook. But I would really advise anything that's agreed, and this is probably a little bit negative, have it in writing. Whatever the plans are, whatever the arrangements are, get everything in writing so that there's, unfortunately, an understanding in place, so that if somebody has a wobble, usually on the employer side, you've got your documented evidence there to protect yourself. Because, you know, you want to avoid the dramas that come from any legal issues or any disputes.
And especially, I suppose, in lots of times when, regardless, male or female, but career progression, and especially if you're in that workplace and you are hit by a serious illness diagnosis, so you have to have a go on treatment. So you have to, if you have to, sideline a slightly. But where do you get to pick that up again? So as you say, have it in writing that there's something there, and it comes back to that whole communication thing.
It does. I mean, you look at maternity leave as an example, and sadly in Ireland it's still one of those issues that's illegal, proving problematic. I don't know why, but there's so much around that. And if you've any sense and any respect for those that are going on maternity leave, you know, you'll know exactly what you should be doing as an employer. You know exactly what steps to take, and you've got to follow it by the law.
Yeah.
But also you can do lots of nice things on the side for that employee that you're meant to be caring about.
Yeah.
Take it to those with cancer diagnoses, and then suddenly there's a black hole of not really understanding. So it's ensuring the communication, things in writing, things detailed, everything just nice and clear. So you're dealing with curing yourself and getting yourself better.
And do we have something, like, I know we have maternity benefit and we have maternity, you know, we understand that, you know, women are entitled to go out for 6 or 9 months or whatever length of time, you know, so much is paid and so much is at their own discretion. Do we not have something in relation to serious illness cover?
No, you see now in the legislation that they're bringing in that you have to be paid for sick leave, and that's coming in next year. So your 5 days, every employer now must cover in a 12-month period for those sick days, which is fine, but pretty useless in you know, Laura's and Emma situation or any serious longer term. But at least it's a start. And again, it's a conversation that's been a long time coming. Yeah. But, you know, no, I mean, the government need to do more. And employers on the smaller business and medium size will say, well, what, we can't do anymore. Mm-hmm. Your restaurants, your vintners and people like that will go, you know, it's shutting us down because we can't do all of these things. My answer to that is the world is changing.
Yeah.
You know, and don't build businesses around employees if you're not going to protect them and look after them.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I think, you know, good employers don't care about the legislation because they'll do the right thing.
Yeah.
Because they'll respect Laura. They'll respect Emma. They've been loyal employees. So what can we do to help and help your family, help your mental state? Mm-hmm. We want you back. We want you back at 100%.
Yeah.
You know, we don't want the sad story. And that's, you know, the kind of communication that should be expected.
I mean, it's a terrible thing to say, but cancer is costly. You know, it's costly. The treatment is costly. Everything is costly. And then on top of that, you have that burden of, well, I need to go back to work because I need to have money coming in. I need to pay, you know, certain outgoings. So, you know, it is something that employers definitely need to be empathetic. Who would you think, if you look globally, what country does it best? Who should we model ourselves off?
Yeah, I mean, you know, okay, we talked about the Netherlands being really good. Finland is a very, very good country. France, ironically, but because France is so rigid with their union approach to how they work, but they are really, really good at protecting their employees and minding their employees. You look at New Zealand, you know, but Finland in particular are cutting edge in terms of hours of work, flexibility, men and women, and you know, it you know, transgender, all of those things. There's thought put into the legislation in these countries because they want to retain the staff. They want to have a proper work environment that's inclusive, that's, you know, makes sense as in the working hours, but also that treats men and women the same. Well, I would say Finland stands above many.
So we have a lot to do.
Oh, miles behind, behind. Wow. We're trying and we have some good politicians that are trying, but you look at how long it's taken the return to work policy.
Yeah.
And it'll be next year, probably, more than likely. And everyone will bicker and argue and pull it apart. And it'll be another 6 to 8 months before it gets into play because there's too much noise and we're not good at adapting to changing how Ireland has been in such a, this is how you work. And you know, remember when you were young, you got the job at the bank because that was pensionable, or you got the job and that was it and you wouldn't move away from that. Now people move jobs after 2 years because they want to progress. They want to change. You know, people who've been a gap in their CV because they've had cancer treatment isn't the big as it was. But, you know, 10 years ago, I was like, yeah, but you've been out of work for a while.
Yeah.
Women trying to return to the workplace, though, is still a little bit of a challenge.
Right.
You know, so again, you know, if you've been out because of cancer for 2 or more years, unfortunately, it's still a challenge. So it's again, making sure whoever you're working with on whether it's a recruiter or whether it's going directly to the employer, that, you know, don't hide your story, own it. Think of what you've learned going through that kind of treatment and that level of treatment that you didn't know about yourself before. That's a learning. That's a skill set that you didn't have before your illness. And again, from a practical point of view, understand with the employer, what home benefits can you have in terms of desk, chairs, you know, get those plans in place as well. If you're one of those people who loved working in the office and didn't want to go home, but your gradual return might be from home at the start. You know, might be maybe a morning in the office and a couple of hours from home. Make sure the setup is there. Employers are responsible for making sure you've got the right equipment, the right setup for yourself at home. You know, how you dress, how you look, you know, there's a flexibility there as well. You know, it's get everything signed, sealed as soon as you know you need to have that conversation, but it's not easy.
So Emma, as a person that is self-employed, did you have health insurance? Did you have any source of sort of, I suppose, security given that you're not going to get supports from anywhere else when you were faced with this kind of a diagnosis?
Yes, luckily, without getting anything from the government and revenues. So I was signed off initially for 6 months saying, you know, you shouldn't be working. But given it was my own business, I did. And luckily, yes, I had health insurance to cover the heavy costs mm-hmm. for all the treatments and the hospital stays and things. And then, yes, I did have serious illness cover that luckily took out with the mortgage. So I got some money there to help out mm-hmm. so that I didn't have to work every day. I could work, you know, a few hours each day or take 3 days off if I needed and get cover. Mm-hmm. So that was really helpful. So I would say it's better to have it and not need it.
Absolutely.
Than, you know, not to have it and you need it. Yeah. Always, I would recommend health cover and...
And it's something that I know a younger population, as in I have a daughter, she's 28, engaged, and her partner didn't have health insurance, had it as part of his family insurance. Mm. Then he was, you know, go out into the big bad world, now get your own health insurance. But it's down their list of priorities, which I found strange. And yet it's so important to have health cover at whatever level. And as you say, well, especially in mortgages, to have that serious illness cover is hugely beneficial. Mm. And how about you, Laura? Like, you know, you were working in Beaumont, but like it's a costly experience.
Well, I was lucky too. I had health insurance. I suppose it's better to kind of be paying for it and have it rather than to be looking for it, you know. Yeah. But I was lucky in that regard as well. And I was able to go to the Bonds in Glasnevin and have my chemotherapy. And then with work, I had 3 months like full pay. Mm-hmm. And then I had 3 months half pay. And then I also qualified for critical illness at work as well, which gave me another 6 months full pay as well. So I was very lucky. I've worked at Beaumont, I have to say, 27 years. Mm-hmm. So I'm part of the furniture there. But, you know, it's a great scheme, you know. Yeah. But then you need to get back to work as well, because you're kind of thinking, God, you know, I wanted to get back to work because I kept some of my illness time. Yeah. Went back to work in case I did need it a couple of months down the line, in case I went back to work and it was too much for me. And yeah, exactly. So I did keep that time as well, but it was great that I didn't actually need to use it, you know. And you have that then for 5 years. Mm-hmm. So.
And any advice from you, Ian, as regards, you know, we see now, yes, you know, people should have health insurance at whatever level. People should look at the you know, if they're getting a mortgage out, to take that other cover for serious illness. Is there any other things that people could do to help ensure that they are covered?
Yeah, I mean, there are cost-effective health cover options that smaller businesses can look at. Again, I'm not going to name the particular organisation, but, you know, for as little as €26 from the employee and that matched by the employer, there are health cover options that they can have. Okay. I mean, it's the Saturday Fund. They won't mind me mentioning.
Okay.
But I only came to it myself in recent years in particular company I work with, because we can't afford to pay for, you know, the bigger brands.
Yeah.
But it is something there that it's a cost effective option. And can cover for certain things. It doesn't cover for everything, but it is a good starting point. But again, you know, it's educating your employees about having that health cover. You know, we're good at doing that where I am in terms of pension and things like that. Don't wait until you're 30. You should be getting it when you're 12.
But yet, you know, and so many of us, I certainly didn't look at pensions when I was in my 30s, you know, and you do wait and it's a little bit late and you're kind of going, oh, now I have to really look at it. But it is something to be aware of.
It is.
You know, because I don't think younger people realise in their 20s and 30s what a pension will mean at the end.
No. And look, you know, it's the thing, we're all infallible until we're not. And it can happen at any age as well, you know, whatever it is. Yeah. So it's being prepared. Mm. So, you know, and again, from an employer perspective, don't be afraid, you know, to have a conversation about your financial, because if you don't ask, you don't know.
Yeah.
Whether they're a small or a big organization, have the conversation. Is there something they can do with the salary? Is there some option that can be put into place for a period of time? You know, it's that sharing.
It's all that communication. Yeah. And don't be afraid to have the conversation.
No.
Worst case they can say is, no, sorry, we can't do it, you know, but at least if you ask the question, you might open doors to other areas to be explored, you know, from both sides.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
And is there anywhere or a resource that you would recommend for people returning after a serious illness diagnosis. So they've been out of the workforce for a year or maybe 18 months. And they're a bit nervous of how they go about approaching employer or looking for a new job. What should they do?
Oh, and that's a really good question. So actually the HSC has really good information on their websites and booklets, and they're actually getting better and better at being more diverse in their thinking and not just looking at a certain area. So that would be my first port of call. And it's that informed information that we're talking about, not going straight to Google.
Yeah.
So I definitely go there. I think, you know, the cancer societies, you know, in their different guises in Ireland are, again, excellent. And there's support groups there. Mm. There are groups outside. And I think Emma referenced one earlier on where, you know, women who have gone through it and supporting each other where they can get advice from each other. Mm-hmm. So I think going into the world of cancer information and the HSC are really good areas to start in. In terms of going back to the workplace, I think it's a more trickier one because some of the recruiters out there are excellent at helping you find the path and how to tell your story for the next role. You need to be careful there that it's a well-established recruitment consultancy, but they can be really, really good at building your brand and building your story. Mm-hmm. Again, there's things from a government point of view that are good booklets to read and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But I think having another human being listen to your story and representing you in the workplace is a nicer start than trying to deal with it on your own. Mm-hmm.
And as you say, you know, there are people out there who may not be wanting to run back in the door to do their 40 hours a week, who might be actually happy. You know, a lot of people say to me, well, after I was diagnosed, changed my perspective on life. You know, I don't have to be the 40 hour a week person. I'm actually really good at 30 hours a week, and it gives me my 10 hours at home or to do a sport or something else that I want to explore, you know. So I suppose, and it's having that understanding, I suppose, what you want yourself, and then being able to communicate that. And it may or may not go your way with your present employer, but I'm sure you will find somebody that it will work for.
Absolutely. And look, there's career advisors and there's holistic guidance individuals out there that help people kind of untangle their brain a little bit, because maybe you've learned something about yourself that you didn't know while you're going through the treatment, going through the illness, that you want to own, and you want that to be part of your next career. So there's guidance people out there and coaches that can help you. And it's not the sad story. It's creating who's the new Emma, or who's the new Laura, and what does your brand look like? Mm-hmm. And going out there into the marketplace without any fear of rejection. Mm-hmm. You know, you can be rejected for having cancer, not having cancer.
Yeah, yeah.
It's getting over that and just being who you are.
And I suppose as an entity in Breast Cancer Ireland, we have built a huge support mechanism of both those who have been through diagnosis, but also our education outreach team who are travelling the length and breadth of the country, talking to, you know, schools, companies, community groups about the importance of understanding good breast health. Some of them have been through a cancer diagnosis themselves. So there is support groups out there, and that's something that people need to be aware of, whether they are through Breast Cancer Ireland or whether they are other support groups. You know, there's lots of warriors out there, there's lots of breast friends, there's loads of different entities who are supporting each other at all of the time, and it is a great resource to have them to, you know, bounce ideas off and any queries and concerns they might have. Well, first and foremost, thank you, Emma, Laura and Ian. I feel there is another episode on this topic in future seasons for sure. And so that's a wrap for our season 2 of More Than a Lump. Since we launched back in March, we've recorded and aired 20 episodes with over 4,000 downloads. And we are so excited that it has been such a great resource for so many who have been impacted by this disease. We're currently preparing for our season 3, which will air in early January 23, and have already started reaching out to some guests, but we thought it would be a good idea to ask you, our listeners, what topics and subject areas you might like to see us cover over the next while. If you have any feedback for us, please email your suggestions to ariley@bciresearch.ie. We'd love to hear from you. And just a gentle reminder that you can listen back to any of our past episodes on iTunes or wherever you listen to this podcast, and all episodes are up on our YouTube channel or on our website. And so that just leaves me to say thank you for listening and for supporting Breast Cancer Ireland. Hosting this More Than a Lump podcast and meeting so many friends and colleagues, as well as meeting some lovely new people, has been a real highlight of this year for me personally. I've learned so much from each and every one of our participants, and it has been a pleasure to share their stories and experiences with you, our listeners. I look forward to sharing a year in review of 22 with you in early January and also giving you a rundown of our plans for 2023. But for now, from all of us on the More Than a Lump podcast and the Breast Cancer Ireland team, be kind to yourself and we'll be back in January. The information in this podcast is based on the personal stories of those we have chatted to. If you are concerned in any way, please contact your GP immediately, or you can contact us at breastcancerireland.com.